I agree with those that are saying we have to fit e-bikes. If we're going to allow them to be used on traditional mountain bike trails, then they have to meet certain classifications. So I like class one, class two. I think that that's important because we don't want to turn a bicycle trail into a motorcycle trail, into an ATV trail. We want to still preserve areas for cyclists to be able to go use. So I am an advocate of that.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. This episode of the Six Ranch Podcast is brought to you by DECKED. That's D-E-C-K-E-D. If you don't know what that is, DECKED is a drawer system that goes in the bed of a pickup truck or a van, and it'll fit just about any American-made pickup truck or van. It's a flat surface on top, and then underneath, there are two drawers that slide out that you can put your gear in, and it's going to be completely weatherproof, so I've never had snow or rain or anything get in there. There's also a bunch of organizational features like the deco line, and there's boxes that you can put rifles or bows or tools, all different sizes. There's some bags and toolkits. There's a bunch of different stuff that you can put in there. But the biggest thing is you can take the stuff that's in your back seat out of your back seat and store it in the drawer system, and it's secure. You can put a huge payload of a couple thousand pounds on top of this deck drawer system. There's tie downs on it, so you could strap down all your coolers and your four-wheeler and whatever else you've got up there. It's good stuff. This is made out of all recycled material that's 100% manufactured in America. And if you go to decked.com/sixranch, you'll get free shipping on anything that you order. This show is possible because companies like DECKED sponsor it. And I would highly encourage you to support this American-made business and get yourself some good gear.
Okay, we've got Brian from Baku. We're in the Cryptech podcast booth here at Hunt Expo. Tell me about Baku, just to get started. For those who don't know, I've been using one for a while, but like generally, what are you?
So Baku is a passion company.
A passion company.
It's a passion company, yeah. Dave and I both had careers before Baku came in and took over life. But we're passionate archery hunters. We love chasing elk in September. And it started with a need. We were looking for a way to get further into the backcountry, how to do it quietly, how to do it scent-free, how to move quickly. And so it really came out of searching for a way for us to get into the backcountry. So one of our taglines is built for hunters by hunters. Yeah. We really didn't look for e-bikes to sell them, to create a company and a product. It was more of a tool for us and how can we become better, more efficient hunters.
Yeah. You know, that scent aspect of things is really interesting. Yeah. I was hunting off scooters in North Carolina for coyotes in December, which is incredible. So we're using these electric scooters. We're riding in with night vision goggles. It's incredibly quiet. You can park the truck a mile or so away from your hunting location and ride in complete silence. One of the really interesting things about the scent, though, is if you have a continuous scent trail, like what a bike tire leads, when an animal intersects that, they can't tell which direction it's going, right?
Love it.
One of the most powerful books that anybody could ever read for hunting is called Predator-Prey Dynamics, The Role of Olfaction.
Yeah.
It's not a sexy title. It's not a sexy book. But you can learn how scent actually works. And if you're training a dog and you just drag whatever's making the scent in a trail continuously, when they intersect that, they can't tell which way it went. But if you make it hop, like what feet do, then they can tell instantly, right? So that's a really powerful thing that played into this hunt in North Carolina. We called in a coyote, killed it, took pictures of it. We've got white lights on everything. We go back to night vision and start to ride out, and there was a coyote coming down our trail. And that would have been impossible if we would have walked in, because it would have known which direction we were walking.
Yep, yep.
But because it was on those scooter tracks, it didn't matter, right?
Yeah.
He didn't know which way we'd gone.
Right.
Its nose was down. It was aware of us. I've got video of all this on thermal.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But it still worked. That scent aspect of it is huge.
Yeah, you can't underestimate that.
Yeah.
You know, anybody that sits in a hunting stand, if you're a whitetail hunter, you certainly know this. You can sit in that stand and watch a doe come through an area where you hiked in to get into your tree stand. And it's like somebody smacked them on the nose when they get to where your boots were on the ground.
Yeah.
They literally, it just, you're putting down more scent through your boot than you actually realize. And the bikes just don't. Directional, one thing. And then just, I think, rubber, because, you know, most of us are riding on old logging roads, and there's been rubber rolling down these roads before. It's more of a natural scent to them, I think, than this human scent that is so strong, that comes with whatever we had for breakfast and whatever, you know, we campfire, we sat around, whatever it might be. So scent can't be underestimated for sure.
Yeah. Oh, it's number one. If there's one thing to understand well in hunting, at least in the West, it has got to be scent and wind.
It's scent. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. And while we're on the subject, there's two types of scent that come off the human body or any body. You leave a scent trail of odorants. So like, molecules that are coming off your body in the form of breath or dead skin cells or hair, anything like that. So imagine everywhere you go, you're just dumping out a salt shaker.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to stick to the ground everywhere you went. And then there's an odorant plume, which is the stuff that's evaporating off you. So when an animal is downwind and smells you, it's that odorant plume. It's the odorant trail if you're walking. And just a hot tip for people, a tactic that I've changed in the past few years is when I walk into a place, I used to like slip in and kind of stay in the shadows. Now I walk through the hottest, most sun-exposed portion because nothing destroys those molecules faster than UV.
Than that heat.
Right?
That sun. Yeah.
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 So that's a hot take for somebody that wants,
I love it,
wants a power play that's counterintuitive, but it really does work, because I've had elk walk over those places where I'm in the shade and they smell it hours later, but if it's in the sun, they don't.
Yeah, that's good information. Yeah, yeah. I mean, any elk hunter learns real quickly. You got to understand thermals, you got to understand scent, you got to understand wind. If you can't get that right, then you may as well head back to camp and hang out at camp, because it's game over.
Yeah. So electric vehicles, they're doing big things. Like you got in at an interesting time with this technology, and it's evolving really quickly.
Yeah.
Tell me about how that technology has changed between when you started and now.
Rapidly. I mean, technology, just like everything else in this world, just seems to be, as soon as you come out with something, man, within 6 months they got something that's improved on it. But now we're getting things where we're you're able to find your bike. You know, we've got some really cool things that are coming out on our models, where you actually guys will get out in an area and they'll put their bike down, kind of like you set a backpack down, you think, oh, I know right where that's at and I'm going to find it when I come back out, and it's not there. There's technology now through GPS that you can actually relocate your bike. You can mark it and find it. You can actually, alarms will be set when you walk away from your bike. It'll automatically, it'll set an alarm and it'll lock the bike down. Or as you get within 50 yards of it, it'll unlock and you'll be able to get on your bike. So some technology that way. But then even just in the gearing and the motors and the electrical aspects of an electric bike have changed drastically as well.
The hub motors.
Yeah, right.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, the big thing that people have to understand when you're looking at an electric bike, there's really two things that make an electric bike, and that is a motor and a battery.
Yeah.
That's what changes the whole thing. So when you're looking to find a bike for whatever application it is, the number one thing you want to look at is motor. Because just like in a vehicle, there's a Honda Civic that is meant to run around town and it gets great gas mileage, but it's not going to pull a 20,000-pound toy hauler. Or you've got a Chevy Duramax that's built to climb and built to pull and be a workhorse. The same thing is the case with e-bikes. You can go with a hub drive, which is more of a low-torque, run around rolling hills, flatter ground e-bike, or you can go to something with a mid-drive, which works in concert with the gears of the bike and is built more for climbing, off-road use, rugged terrain, built for pulling, carrying, towing. And then even within that mid-drive class, kind of like you've got your Toyota 4Runner, your Toyota Tacoma, and then you've got your Tundra, and then you've got, you know, your diesel vehicles. Mid-drives are the same way. You can have a lower-end mid-drive that is built more for mileage and is capable, but it's still not built to pull and carry and to tow. And so we build our bikes because our bikes are built for the backcountry. They're built to haul gear and haul people and to haul out your game when you get it. So our bikes are built around heavy-duty, all-metal gearing, componentry of the motor itself that is built and structured for that.
Right.
And then the next thing that you're going to look at is batteries. All batteries aren't created equal. Just like, you know, when you go to the grocery store, you can buy a 9-volt for $3 or you can buy one for 12. Well, our batteries are built with the long-lasting lithium-ion cells. They're built with the $12 cell, kind of that Energizer Duracell type cell that is built to hold a charge for a longer period of time. So you can go further on a single charge and they last longer. So, you know, you'll get... People ask all the time, well, how long will my battery last? Well, one, it'll last just like your car battery, 5, 6, 7 years if you take care of it. And two, you're going to get maximum distance out of it per charge. And so not only do you get a battery that's going to last for a long period of time, but it's also going to give you maximum distance during those 5 to 6 years that you're using it.
Something I really appreciate about your guys' gear is that you undersell its capabilities. So, this doesn't happen across the outdoor space, right? If you get a sleeping bag that is rated for 30 degrees,
yeah,
that is the survival rating, right?
Right.
So
right.
At 29 degrees, you die.
Right.
Right?
Right. Yes, exactly.
So, like the Grizzly is the scooter of yours that I use,
uh-huh.
And I love it. It makes me smile every time I get on it. I ride it for the pure joy of it. And riding the Grizzly scooter at night in the summertime with night vision is just my favorite thing in the world.
Oh.
It is phenomenal. I think you have that rated for 270 pounds, something like
yes.
that.
Yes. Yep. Yep. Right in that range.
Right. So I'm 300 pounds and I've put a trailer on it with 100 pounds of salt to yep. go feed cattle.
Yep.
And it does all of that, right?
Oh, yeah.
I rode it from Enterprise, Oregon to Joseph, Oregon on the back roads. It was 18 miles with 1,000 feet of elevation gain, and it made it.
Like I love it.
Right? That's incredible. And that's yeah. one of those hub-driven motors that yeah. isn't known for, you know, high torque or anything like that. But it's doing it. So I just wanted to say that, like, I really appreciate that you are underselling the actual capabilities of what you're doing rather than, you know, overselling it or putting it right at that sort of survival rating.
Yeah, yeah, sure. No, I mean, that's important to us. Relationships and what people think of our products means a lot to us. It's not about just selling something. It really is selling a lifestyle, selling an adventure, selling something that is going to improve people's lives. And if they purchase it under a certain pretense that it's going to do this and it doesn't do that for them, then we take that personal. And
yeah.
so, no, we definitely try to overbuild our stuff so that it'll do what you want it to do and the expectations that you have for it.
For
and
sure.
I love that Grizzly scooter. We built that similar to our bikes in the sense that it has about a foot of clearance. So you've got great clearance to go over some rocky terrain.
Yep.
It has that 1,000-watt hub drive motor that really will push you up some hills. It's not meant for a long sustaining climb for an extended period of time, but it'll certainly climb. And then it's just built with great components from, you've got to have good brakes. You've got to have some hydraulic piston brakes that are going to grab that rotor and stop you. Because like you say, when you're pulling 100 pounds behind you and you're weighing a couple hundred plus yourself, you got to have brakes that are going to stop you, keep you safe. And
the brakes are quiet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, when I'm on an electric scooter, electric bike, a huge portion of it is just sound.
Yeah.
And a bicycle is quieter than walking. It, it can't have rattles, it can't have squeaks, and that fits the bill. Another thing that I really, really like about the scooter is how easy it is to get on and off.
Yeah.
Right? I don't have to sling my leg up over anything. And if you're wearing a pack and you're trying to roll your leg up over a bicycle seat, that's kind of a tricky move. And another thing that I really appreciate about electric bikes, and there is a degree of controversy around them, which is unfounded in my opinion, but you've created something that allows people with physical disabilities to access places that they otherwise wouldn't be able to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And what a gift.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no, it makes you feel good. I mean, in so many ways, it makes you feel good because you're enhancing people's lives. You're allowing them to get outdoors and to enjoy, you know, get away from the stresses of life and enjoy life and take a little bit of break from the stresses of life. It makes you feel good with regards to the environment because we're not putting out emissions.
Yeah.
The impact that it has to the trails is very minimal. Soil samples have been done that show an electric bike doesn't have any more impact on the trail than a regular pedal bicycle would. And certainly a lot less stress on trails than even a horse would put on a trail. And so feel good about that you're being good to the environment, you're being good to people, and creating adventure and creating opportunity. And certainly, you know, those that have disabilities, it allows them to do things that they ordinarily would not be able to do, as well as many people that maybe used to be able to do it, but maybe age or illness or whatever maybe has now made them so that they can't do that. And these bikes essentially light that fire again and allow them to get out and do the things that they did 10 years ago that maybe they can't.
Yeah.
Couldn't for the last few years.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a very special thing. And anybody who wants to take that away, they're really not acting with the amount of compassion that one human is due to show another.
Yeah, for sure.
Tell me about your elk hunt with Marcy.
So yeah, we've had some fun hunts together. But I think if you're referring to the one in particular, we did a hunt on some R&K property here in Utah, and we were chasing around bulls anywhere from probably 220 to maybe 300 class bulls, and we had the bikes and we were just moving through the trees and we'd get on top of a herd, and then we had a big herd bull pushing his cows through some trees, and we'd jump off the bikes and try to get in on them, and then they'd skirt down the mountain, never saw us, but they just were moving fast enough. It was in the evening, and we were just, it was a run and gun type of night, one night in particular that I recall, and we come flying down this hill. We knew we had maybe 15 minutes left of light. Brian had a call that he'd been blowing on all week long, and it was on its last leg. It was as a matter of fact, he even had to take not only the reed was going, but the actual tube was going. And so anyway, we flying down this hill and come around this corner, and he slams on his brakes. I slam on my brakes. My son's right behind me. He hits his brakes. We almost slam into each other. There's this whole herd of elk, maybe 80 yards out in the middle of this field, this big old herd bull screaming and going off, and we're trying to get in position of them. It just created for such one of those moments that you'll just remember for life. We didn't even harvest an animal. I didn't even draw my bow back that night, but we were just chasing animals all over the mountain. They never even saw us until that last herd out in the middle of the field. And then we tried to put the sneak on them. You know, you've got 15 minutes of shooting light left, and by the time we could get into position, we got in some bad wind and shifted on us and kind of blew them out. But the bikes just allowed us to go from one end of the mountain all the way to the other end as this herd is moving through the trees, and he's pushing them down canyons and over little ridges and dropping down into this big meadow. And we couldn't have done that without the bikes. We would have been stuck up on the hill just watching them move down through the trees. And so it created a special memory for us.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's it's pretty special to add that maneuver element to it and be able to add some speed and show up fresh, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Elk are cool animals.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny because most of us, we get so amped up for a hunt that we show up and that day one, what do? We go gangbusters. Like we get out, we put 10 miles on our boots and we're all over the mountain. And then we wake up the next morning and we're like, oh man, I got 5 miles in me today. So then we hunt a 5 mile perimeter. And by day three, usually we're getting a little fatigued. Our feet are a little sore, knees are maybe a little sore. The bikes just allow you to cover more ground. It allows you to get out and cover more area. Instead of just saying, hey, I'm going to hunt this canyon today, you can ride that old logging road. You can throw bugles up every 100 yards or so, and you can cover that entire front, not just that one canyon. And they really are a game changer with regards to being able to cover more ground, to do it quietly, to do it quickly, to be scent free. And then it adds an element of just fun.
Yeah.
It really does. They're just fun to ride and, you know, to feel the breeze out there. You're only doing 8 to 10 miles an hour. But you can hear animals. You can hear the bulls bugling up on the hillside when you're riding in. And it's a great experience.
Yeah, it is. What's the future of this? Like, do you have a sense of where this technology might be in 10 years? Because it is something that's changing so quickly. It can be an impediment to somebody deciding to make a decision to buy this because they're like, well, what if something way better comes out next year?
Yeah. You know, I think there's certainly going to be some advancements, but at the end of the day, we want them to be considered bicycles. So we're not trying to turn these things into a motor vehicle. We're not trying to turn them into a motorcycle. We want them to be a bicycle. That's what they're for. Right now, there's classes of e-bikes. There's Class 1 through Class 4.
Talk me through that because that's confusing to a lot of people.
Okay.
Including myself.
Yeah. So a Class 1 e-bike we're in Utah right now. So a Class 1 e-bike in Utah and in most states throughout the U.S., Class 1 e-bikes are considered non-motorized. And so you can ride a Class 1 e-bike anywhere that you could ride a regular pedal bicycle. And a Class 1 e-bike meets requirements if the motor is 750 watts or less.
Okay.
And they chose 750 watts because 750 watts is the equivalent of 1 horsepower. So they said, well, if we're going to allow a horse on this trail, then anything that has 1 horsepower or less should be considered able to use this trail. So 750 watts or less. Next thing is it has to be pedal assist only. In other words, it doesn't have a throttle. You can't get on and hit a throttle and ride without using the pedals. So pedal assist, 750 watts or less. And then last thing is that the motor can't assist you beyond 20 miles per hour.
Okay.
So the motor can help you up to 20 miles per hour, but not beyond that. And at that point, you know, if you can pedal faster, then that's just fine. Anybody can do that on a regular bike, but the motor doesn't assist you beyond that. So that's Class 1. Those three parameters.
This is Utah specific?
This is throughout the United States.
Okay.
Utah kind of adopted this policy because it was put into place. I don't know if it was California or what state first tried to classify e-bikes and kind of figure out where they fit with regards to bicycles and motorcycles and motor vehicles. And so they came out with these classes. And Utah adopted that. And like I say, most states throughout the U.S. adopt the 4 classifications. So that's Class 1. Class 2 is exactly like Class 1, except for you're allowed to use a throttle. So, and a lot of people will argue, well, does it matter if it's only a 750 watt motor and the motor only assists you to 20 miles per hour? Does it really matter if you use a throttle or if you're pedaling? Because there might be somebody that they're out riding and maybe they are trying to lose some weight. Maybe they're trying to get into better health and they can only ride so far with the pedals. And then maybe they need that throttle to help them, give them a little breather for 30 seconds. And then they start pedaling again. And so there's a lot of places that allow you to ride a Class 2 bike. As a matter of fact, the national parks throughout the U.S., they allow Class 1 and Class 2 e-bikes to be used in all national parks. And then there's Class 3. Class 3 goes back to what Class 1 is. It's pedal assist only, 750 watt only, but it allows the motor to assist you to 28 miles per hour.
Okay.
So that allows you to get a little more speed up to 28 miles per hour, a little more assistance. And then class four is kind of unrestricted. So class four puts you more in that motorcycle category. Most states would consider that a motorized vehicle. And you can have 1,000 watt or 1,500 watt. You can have a throttle. The motor can assist you as high as you want it to okay. assist you. So so to answer your question of how's this going to evolve, technology is going to evolve, and we're going to probably have better gearing and shifting, and it's going to be more fine-tuned, and the motors are probably going to, over time, they're going to be built to last for 20 years instead of 10 years or whatever it is, longevity of components and stuff. But it's still going to have to fit within that bicycle realm. And I think you're going to see these classes that are going to kind of form that. And although the product will evolve and become better, and you know, our, just like our cars last a little bit longer maybe and they're a little more efficient, same thing's going to happen with bikes. But it's not a matter of, you know, hold off now because it's going to change everything in the future. It's still going to have to fit within the box of that class one.
Gotcha. What is your favorite Baku bike to ride?
Well, it depends on what I'm doing. Yeah. So we have a bike called, it's our sport trail bike, and it's built more around just sport trail riding. It's called the Scout. So the Scout is built around the guy that 80% of the time loves to just sport trail ride. 20% of the time, he wants to turn it into a utility type bike, and he wants to hunt off it and do things like that. So the suspension and the geometry of the bike is built for the guy that loves to get out on the trails and just loves to ride, but then also wants to throw a rack on it and turn it into a utility bike. So if I'm just going out trail riding, the Scout, the suspension on it is off the charts. It's just a comfortable ride, and the geometry just puts you in a great position. If I'm hunting,
what do you mean by geometry?
So the geometry is based when we design a frame, and we work with engineers to design the frame, and we're thinking about the capabilities of that bike, we're going to set up the frame so that it puts the rider in a particular position. Are you in more of an upright position, or are you more in an athletic position where you're stretched out and you're making more of an athletic type riding pattern? So our storm's going to stretch you out a little bit more, put you a little more aerodynamic, put you in a position for more of a sport trail riding, as opposed to like our Mule or our Storm, which are built more for a utility type hunter. If you're a guy that wants to use it 80% of the time to hunt and then 20% of the time to go out and enjoy the trails, then you're going to choose something more of our hardtail Mule, which has been kind of our flagship bike and the number one selling hunting bike in the U.S. for the last 4.5 years. It has been.
Congratulations.
Yeah. It's off the charts, and we sell a ton of the Mules. It's a great bike, but we had some guys that said, I want the Mule with that powerful motor, all the gearing, all the suspension, but I also want more of a comfortable ride. I want full suspension, mm-hmm. where the Mule is just has the front air shocks. It doesn't have a rear suspension on it. And some guys like that. They want that solid rear end. But then other guys were like, I ride some rugged stuff, and I would like the full suspension. So then the Storm came into play, and it was patterned after the Mule with all the same componentry, same motor, same batteries, but then has full suspension. So if I'm out hunting, then I'm grabbing the Mule or the Storm. If I'm doing a lot of trail riding, then I'm going to grab the Scout. We also have our Mav 3, which is kind of built for our bigger riders, our guys that, you know, 300, 350 pounds and maybe 6'5" to 6'10". We've got NBA players that use them. Mm-hmm. It's built for more of that big, rugged, tires are, instead of 4-inch tires, they're 5-inch tires. The suspension's a little beefier, built for that type of rider. So for me, yeah, it depends on what I'm going after.
I think I rode the Storm at the last Sig Hunter Games, and that thing was a rocket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I felt like if the bark was right, I could climb a tree.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yes.
Something that we're starting to see a little bit more of is two-wheel drive bikes. Are you guys getting into that yet?
We do. We have our Kodiak, our Kodiaqs and all-wheel drive bikes. So coming back to that hub drive discussion that we had, it has not only a motor in the rear hub, but it has a motor in the front hub. And the Kodiaq is perfect for the guy that hunts in an area where maybe it's a little more sandy terrain because of that all-wheel drive. It churns and moves through the sand really well. If you're in an area where you're hunting in some snow, it moves through the snow really well. Maybe some mud, a little bit of mud. Now, the clingy mud that we get sometimes in the Midwest and other areas, clingy mud, it doesn't matter if you're riding a bicycle or you're riding a motorcycle, a four-wheeler, or a pickup truck. Clingy mud sticks to tires.
Right.
And so the Kodiaq does better than the other bikes because it has two wheels that are churning and moving through it, but it still has its limitations if that mud's grabbing the tires. But it does really well in snow, does really well in sand. Because it's the hub drive, it'll climb. Even though it's all-wheel drive, guys would think, oh, well, that's going to outclimb the rest of them. No, it's still a hub drive. It still has front and rear hubs, and it's not. It doesn't create the amount of torque that that mid-drive motor, ultra motor that we have on our Storm and on our Scout and on our Mule has. So you're going to choose that based on the terrain that you're riding in if you want the all-wheel drive for sand, snow, mud, stuff like that, but not necessarily for Western hunters that are climbing the steep stuff.
Gotcha. Talk me through, and you did it a couple of years ago, but talk me through sort of how these traditional derailleurs and stuff that we grew up with have changed, because now they're so much more reliable, so much more internal. The shifting is a pleasurable experience rather than like, I feel like this bicycle is going to eat me at some point, you know?
Well, one thing that we pride ourselves on at Baku is that we use top-end components, and we use them from reputable companies. We design our own frames, we engineer our own frames, and we do that because of the applications that we want to use them for. But we're not going to pretend that we know everything about every component of every bike. We don't build our own spokes. We don't build our own cassettes and our own shifting mechanisms. So we use the top brands in the industry. We use SRAM and we use Shimano. And as these companies advance and get better at what they're doing, then it only helps us in providing that product on our bikes that makes our products and our bikes better as well. And they have advanced. They've got the timing down. They've got the cable, the poles, and the way the cables pull, and the way the derailleur moves the chain across the cassette better. They've got narrow and wide teeth on the cassettes that allow it to roll better and just perform better. And then there's little set screws in the derailleur that allow the novice or the lay person to be able to adjust their derailleur very easily. You don't have to take it to a bike shop and have a professional do it anymore. You can actually adjust it with just a little Phillips screwdriver right on the trail. If you feel like something's just not shifting correctly, it allows you to be able to dial things in.
Yeah. And it's just more reliable.
Yeah.
Like it feels to me like you're not having to take your bike into the shop and get everything tuned right because it's trying to skip between gears.
Right. No. And that is one thing that, you know, just cycling in general, they've just gotten better, these component companies, that's what they do. And, you know, we do have some input. So there's some things like we've come out, you know, e-bikes are new for the most part in the U.S. They haven't been around very long. When Baku started in late 2016, we didn't know of any other hunting e-bike brands out there. And in Europe and in Asia, they weren't building hunting e-bikes or backcountry e-bikes. They're building e-bikes for commuters, and they've been around for a number of years in Europe and in Asia, but they weren't built for what we're doing. So what we have found is that we've then had to go back to these manufacturers and say, we need heavier duty componentry. We need that cassette to be thick and heavy and your strongest metal, not something that is lightweight and is shaving grams.
Yep.
We want that thing to be bulletproof. We're not so worried about weight like a lot of traditional cyclists are, spending $1,000 to drop 10 grams. We want that heavy duty componentry. And so we've worked with many manufacturers in designing and developing these components that are built heavy duty so that they'll stand up to the rigors of that heavy duty motor and all the demands that are being placed on it.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, it saves a lot of headaches for all of us when you're out in the backcountry, for sure.
Because there is a sector of bicycling where weight is everything. So they're willing to sacrifice durability for you know, fractions of an ounce.
Yes. And it's true. It's in everything in cycling. They're trying to shave grams. Yeah. And I get it. When you're racing Tour de France, you know, those guys are every ounce on that bike when they're climbing some of those steep ascents, that matters. Their legs are screaming at them, and they want to drop that weight as much as they can. But when you've got the assistance of a motor, the weight isn't so important, and especially when you're building a utility-style hunting bike like we do, you want it to be capable, not lightweight.
What's one current restriction on e-bikes that you agree with and one that you disagree with?
I agree with those that are saying we have to fit e-bikes. If we're going to allow them to be used on traditional mountain bike trails, then they have to meet certain classifications. So I like class 1, class 2. I think that's important because we don't want to turn a bicycle trail into a motorcycle trail, into an ATV trail. We want to still preserve areas for cyclists to be able to go use. So I am an advocate of that, a big advocate of that. And in staying within, you know, kind of staying within where we fit. And where I probably struggle is along the same lines that, you know, cyclists have been around for a long time, and there's a lot of cycling purists that believe, oh, if you've got any type of assistance, then that's cheating, and that's motorized, and it shouldn't be on our trails. And I disagree with that, because for many of the reasons we just said, it's allowing people to get out and enjoy things that they otherwise couldn't do. And it's a different type of enjoyment. Even for somebody like myself, I've raced triathlons, I raced Ironman events, and I was a cyclist long before Baku came along, and I love the burn in my lungs of riding a bike and climbing hills. But this is a different type of recreation, a different type of enjoyment. And when I'm wanting to ride my e-bike and it's not having any more impact on the trail than a regular pedal bicycle would, and these soil samples show that they don't, then there's no reason to limit them. And if they're not, you know, if they're not creating more harm or danger to others on the trail, I would say the guys that are riding these downhill bike trails on a regular bike without a motor on it are moving a lot faster and probably even a little more reckless than the guys that are riding an e-bike. So I would like to see them come together, and for the cycling purists to say there is room for this. If you're fitting within this, then that should be allowed.
Yeah. I see some of that elitism in the archery sector with, you know, guys that are longbow only or guys that are trad bow only. So they'll accept recurves. Yep. And then, you know, there's so many compound guys that just abhor the thought of shooting a crossbow.
Yeah.
And I think that we're at a really interesting stage with crossbows because they're very popular. They're very old. Crossbow technology, I think, came about in the 1500s. Mm-hmm. So if you want to talk traditional, crossbows are, many ways, a lot more traditional than a compound bow. And they allow people to access archery hunting who otherwise wouldn't be able to, oftentimes.
Yeah.
And when I see people oppose that, it kind of hurts me. Now, I love shooting every kind of bow. I don't own a crossbow, but in Oregon, where I live, it's illegal to use a crossbow for hunting regardless. Like, there's no medical waivers, there's no nothing, you can't do it. And that's driven by this sort of traditional mindset of what it means. I think that is crazy to take, say, a veteran who's missing a limb and look that guy in the eye and say, you're not allowed to archery hunt. You know, you can't take a crossbow. If somebody's using a crossbow, that affects my experience of using a compound or a recurve.
Yep.
Not at all, right? Doesn't affect me at all. And every argument against crossbows was once used against compounds.
Exactly.
Right? We just changed it by 20 years.
Yes.
And if you go back to the, you know, early 90s, everything that people were saying about compounds is exactly what they're saying about crossbows today.
Exactly.
So I keep coming back to it, but it's so important to me for people to be able to access nature, to move around. And if there's a tool that allows them to do that, that doesn't hurt the environment or affect other people's experiences in a negative way, I'm all for it. So I think people need to be a little bit more open-minded about this. And for those who are thinking about it and thinking about embracing it, this is a significant investment. Like your bikes cost thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So where can they go to like try one out to see if it's worth their money?
Well, we have dealers throughout the U.S., so they can find us at www.baku.com.
How's Baku spelled?
B-A-K-C-O-U.
Why is it spelled like that?
Because of the stress that you put on the syllables for backcountry. And so we started off as Backcountry E-Bikes.
Yeah.
And then over time realized, you know what, we need to create something that is our own. How do we do? Backcountry is such a broad term that if you do a Google search, you'll see 1,000 businesses that are backcountry.
And it can't be defined either.
And it can't be defined. Whereas Baku, we get to define that.
Yep.
And so stress on the syllables is where we went to B-A-K. And we still have people all the time put the C in front of the K. But B-A-K-C-O-U, that'll get them to our homepage. And right at the top of the homepage, they can go to our dealer locator. You can find one of our locators, find the one that's nearest to you, and you can go, you know, sit on it, feel it, test it, ride it around. If you live in an area where there's not a dealer right next door, we don't want you to worry there either. Call one of our customer service folks. We're going to tell you all about, we're going to ask you first, what are you going to use it for? What's your application?
Yep.
And then we're going to talk you through what bike would maybe fit you the best. You know, how tall are you? What's your leg length? What are you going to use it for? How far do you want to ride it? Those types of questions. And we're going to tell you what bikes are built for that type of a use. And then if you don't have a dealer next to you, we're going to send you a bike and we're going to let you sit on it, ride it, test it. And if it's not exactly what we told you it was and it's not everything you thought it was, you can send that thing back for a full refund.
That's
so
nice.
So, you know, we can't necessarily put a dealer right next door to everybody.
Sure.
But we've got them throughout the country. But if for some reason there's not one right next to you, rest assured that we're going to ship it to you. And if it's not exactly what you thought it was going to be, send it back. We'll give you a full refund.
And can they go test these bikes at Kryptek, for example?
They can.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've got bikes right at the Kryptek headquarters.
Nice.
So you can see them there. You can see them in the Kryptek patterns, too.
Yeah.
Sharp-looking bike. Our Storm in particular has the Kryptek patterns on it and just is off the charts. Beautiful bike. Beautiful, beautiful bike.
The stuff that I like doing are expedition-style hunts that are multi-day. I like to go as far as I possibly can. There are some limitations that come along with that. Can you overcome that with like bringing extra batteries or solar panels? Like how do you extend that beyond that 20 miles or so?
Yeah. So to give you an idea, most people, I'll bet the most popular question we get is how far can I go?
Sure.
And there's a lot of variables to that. It's kind of like a vehicle. You know, if you're driving your pickup truck with a dry bed, you're going to get better gas mileage than you are if you're pulling your toy hauler behind it. Same thing with these bikes. Depends on the demands you're putting on it. If it's pulling around a guy that weighs 150 pounds or a guy that weighs 300 pounds, it's going to use more battery. But to give you an idea, I weigh about 170 pounds. And I get, out of our long-lasting lithium-ion cells, I get about 2 miles per amp hour on our bikes. So we have varying levels of battery sizes. And we have entry-level batteries that start at 17.5 amp hours. And we go all the way up to 25 amp hours, which is the biggest in the industry. So just doing the simple math, 2 miles per amp hour on a 25 amp hour battery, I get roughly 50 miles. And that's 50 miles, hunting miles. So that's riding the hills of Idaho, uphill, downhill, using the bike for which it was intended, using the throttle to climb a hill every now and then to keep myself from perspiring and sweating and stinking up the mountain. But then when I get on that flatter logging road that I'm dropping it down into a level assist one and I'm being battery conscientious, I'm going to get about 50 miles. If I drop down to our entry-level battery at a 17.5, I'm somewhere in that 34, 35-mile range. If I'm just riding around town and I'm doing a lot less work and I'm not carrying a pack on my back, then I'm going to get more than that.
And say you're in a scenario where you might need 100 miles of range. Can you just bring an extra battery?
Absolutely. Yeah. You can. We have guys that we have bags of a pannier bag that sits on top of the rear pannier rack that is built specifically to carry a battery. And so you can buy an extra battery, you put it in a padded battery case, and then you put it in that pannier bag and you can ride with it. And you got a couple of 25 amp hour batteries, you're going to get your 100 miles. And then you can have a solar panel. If you're setting up camp and you're back in the back country for a week or so, you can, when you jump off your bike, you can throw that solar panel up. It folds up into about a 13 by 13 inch square. You can carry it along with you, unfold it, open it up. It's 200 watts. It'll take about 4 hours to charge a battery. If you've got a clear view of the sun,
That's not bad.
About 4 hours to charge that battery from zero all the way to full.
That's a lot less than what I would have expected. That's a really fast charge.
And it does have something to do with a clear view of the sun.
Sure.
If it's a cloudy day, it might take another couple hours, but you don't need to have it fully charged. If you ride that thing back 5 or 6 miles and you just want to top it off, you know, it's going to do that in 45 minutes, half hour.
Wow.
So you've got options. And if you want to have two batteries and leave one at camp and one's charging while you're out riding the other one, you come back each day and you just swap one out and you take off. We have a lot of guys that do that as well.
Well, the strongest endorsement that I could possibly give, and I keep coming back to it, folks, if you are predator hunting or interested in it and you can get your hands on one of these scooters and night vision or even just a headlamp, like if you don't want to spend the money on night vision, just, you know, get a headlamp with a red lens and you can really sneak in there. But if you can get some night vision and a helmet to be able to make that wearable, I'm telling you, there's just no greater joy than riding backcountry roads or trails at night with night vision and just watching the world that you didn't know existed, slipping into those spots, you know, doing your coyote stand for 15 or 20 minutes, moving on to the next one. It is just some of the most fun hunting I've ever done in my life. And that Grizzly scooter is the ticket. It is the ticket. I think it is just, it's so deadly. And even if you're just riding in to do daylight hunting and you're riding in the dark, really, really powerful tool.
Oh, it is. And, you know, It's a new concept for people. People, when they think about riding a scooter in the mountains, it just doesn't seem to jive. But once you do it, we built the scooter for the exact reason that you said a moment ago. We built it so that it's easy on and off.
Yep.
Sometimes riding on a bike and you see an animal off the side of the road, it's a little more work to get your leg over that rear pannier rack, to get the bike scooted over the side. Whereas a scooter, you just step off and drop the kickstand or lay the scooter right on its side, and it really is a run and gun type of option. And so we have more and more people that are recognizing that. And as the word gets out, we have two big scooters. We have our Timberwolf and our Grizzly. You've mentioned the Grizzly, which is 1,000-watt rear hub and really good clearance. Gives you about 13 inches of clearance, gives you a big wide platform for your feet to stand on. Our Timberwolf is 2,500 watts. So it's an all-wheel drive, but 500 watts. So it comes back to application. What are you going to use it for and how are you going to use it? It doesn't have quite as much clearance. It's got more of a 6 to 7 inches of clearance, but it's built more for, you know, riding in those areas where maybe you're going to be in some sand or some snow or some mud. And you need to be able to churn through some things a little bit more that way. And as people are learning more and the application of the Grizzly and the Timberwolf scooter, we're getting far more comments now than we were 6 months ago about how it's changing the way people are enjoying the out the backcountry.
Yeah,
the outdoors.
It's the ticket for me. And the ground clearance is huge, but it's still really easy to step on and off of. It's really quiet to step on and off of. There's nothing that you're going to hang up on.
Yep.
I stripped almost everything off mine. So, like, if you could bolt it on, I've unbolted
pulled it off
at this point. So it's very, very slick. And it's extremely quiet. And I just get off. I quietly set the thing on the ground and then go about doing whatever I'm going to do. It's full suspension. It has huge tires.
Yep.
Right? How big are those tires?
They're 26-inch tires, and they're 4-inch fat tire.
Right.
So 26 by 4, which is exactly what we have on our Mule and on our Storm and on our Scout.
So this isn't the lime green thing that you're scooting around town in.
No.
Like, this is a real full suspension thing.
This is a big, fat 26-inch fat tire like you'd have on your bike.
Yep. And the platform that you stand on is big. It's like standing on a wider skateboard or something.
Yes.
Like, you know, you could pull off dance moves on that thing.
Exactly. No, and you hit on a key point there. The Grizzly is our full suspension scooter.
Yep.
So it's the 1,000-watt full suspension, front air suspension, rear air suspension, whereas our Timberwolf is just front suspension. It's not full suspension, and but it's the all-wheel drive. So here again, that's why it's important to reach out to us. We'll talk you through the details and help you make sure you make the right choice for what you're going to be using it for, whether it's all-wheel drive, whether it's mid-drive, whether it's hub drive, whether it's full suspension or hardtail.
Yeah. And I hunt off of a motorcycle a lot. I think that's a really undervalued hunting tool. I ride, you know, some form of motorcycle all year long, whether it's in the like an adventure bike in the summer or a snow bike in the winter. I've found that the Grizzly does pretty well in the snow, like much better than I thought it was going to do.
Oh yeah.
And even with me being a big heavy guy, those 4-inch tires provide a lot of flotation, flotation.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they're not super knobby, so they're not flinging stuff all over the place.
Yeah.
But I've never come into a situation where I felt like I needed a more aggressive tread on that tire to be able to get purchase to go.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the great things about a fat tire is that you can increase the PSI or decrease the PSI depending upon the terrain that you're riding in. So if you're riding in sand or snow, you can drop the PSI of those tires down to 13 PSI, get a little broader space on top of the terrain that you're riding on, and it keeps you afloat. As opposed to if you're riding on something that's a little more hard packed, you can pump that up to 20, 22 PSI, and it rolls a little bit better on the hard packs.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Any pieces of parting advice for somebody that's considering their first electric bike of one form or another?
Well, yeah, I think number one is educate yourself. Make sure that you're educated, that you know what you're buying. There's a lot of options out there, but you know we see quite frequently, because of the confusion with e-bikes being so new, somebody sees a fat tire bike and they think, oh, that must be an off-road capable bike, and it's not. It's a commuter bike that has fat tires that somebody's making look like it's a hunting bike or a backcountry bike. They're not built with the same componentry. And so do your research, make sure that you understand motors, batteries, and componentry, and that you're buying a bike that is built for what you want to use it for. I think that that's first and foremost. And then you really do. Unfortunately, in our world today, you get what you pay for. So, you know, to go out and buy, you're going to have a great time on a $1,500 e-bike, riding it around town and around the neighborhood and down to the park and things, but you're not going to get the same off-road experience on that bike that you're going to get on one that is meant for that type of riding. So you know, sometimes that little extra money, I would say in motor and in battery, is going to make you a happier consumer in the long run, because they're expensive. You know, whether you're spending $1,500, you're spending $6,000, they're a lot of money.
Yep.
And so you want to make sure that it's gonna last, and that you're going to be able to have several years of enjoyment out of it. At Baku, we build our bikes that they really don't lose their value. We have customers that have had them for 6-7 years. I had a guy text me the other day, has 12,000 miles on his bike. He's had it for 3 years, and he just bought a new one, sold that one to a son, and bought a new one because he wanted full suspension on his next bike, and went with the Scout. And so buy something that's going to hold its value, that you can upgrade or move down to another family member when you get another one.
Yeah, I think that's really solid advice. The only thing that I would add to that is don't be afraid to try it.
Yeah.
If bicycles haven't been your thing in the past, maybe you wrecked on one, you had some kind of a bad experience, this is different in a meaningful way. So if you get the opportunity to go sit on one and spin it around the block and see what you think, I just dare you not to smile.
Yeah.
It's
good
fun.
Luck not smiling.
Yeah.
They are fun.
Because that's an instant reaction I've seen from everybody, is like, as soon as they start going, you know, there's a few seconds of figuring it out, and then it's a smile. It's like, oh, this is great.
We call it the e-bike smile. And as a matter of fact, at shows for the first 3 or 4 years, we haven't done it the last couple of years, but for the first few years, even here at the Western Hunt, we would set up trail cams to capture that first 10 seconds when somebody would ride through one of our test areas.
Yeah.
Because we knew what they were going to do. That smile, that was, because they couldn't anticipate just how cool it really feels when you're out there. And to speak towards safety, I love how you mentioned, don't be afraid of it. We do build our bikes with these fat tires for a safety reason as well. They're very stable.
Yeah.
You know, you're riding off road, which the fat tire gives you a lot more stability, but it also gives you stability even on hard pavement.
Yep.
We've all ridden bikes before where we come around a corner and we think, oh man, if I hit that gravel, it's going out from underneath me. You don't feel that on our bikes because of the geometry, the way they're set up and built to be stable. And then with those fat tires, the way they grip the road, you don't feel vulnerable riding on them.
Yeah. Awesome stuff, man. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Folks, if you're at all interested, at least go to the website, which is BAKCOU.com. And if you've got questions, give these guys a call. They're going to be more than happy to help you with it. And if you've got more questions about my experience, specifically with the Grizzly, because that's what I've ridden the most, of course, you can reach out to me on Instagram anytime, and I will get back to you.
Love it.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it. I hope you have a great show.
Yes,
thank you
wonderful.
For your time.
You too. Thank you.
I just want to take a second and thank everyone who's written a review, who has sent mail, who's sent emails, who's sent messages. Your support is incredible. And I also love running into you at trade shows and events and just out on the hillside when we're hunting. I think that that's fantastic. I hope you guys keep adventuring as hard and as often as you can. Art for the Six Ranch podcast was created by John Chatelain and was digitized by Celia Harlander. Original music was written and performed by Justin Hay, and the Six Ranch podcast is now produced by Six Ranch Media. Thank you all so much for your continued support of the show, and I look forward to next week when we can bring you a brand new episode.